You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
As well as one could be these days.
Well, you just flew in from somewhere, right? So you're jet lagged, maybe?
It's California, not too much of a jet lag. I'm fine.
Yeah. Well, jet lag is the price you pay for being influential, Rob. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Robert Malley. You are the lead negotiator.
You're a lead negotiator.
Okay. So some people have overstated your role in world
affairs. I always try to correct them and they never listen.
Okay, I'm going to repeat the error just I'm going to call you the lead negotiator. I don't care.
No, I don't want you to, because if, you know, what I don't want is for Wendy Sherman or Secretary Kerry to start thinking that I'm trying to play a role that I wasn't playing. So I would ask you to say.
I can't believe John Kerry is sensitive about credit, Rob. Come on. Okay, so we're talking about the 2015 Iran nuclear deal that the Obama administration forged. Which, of course, Trump abandoned in his first term, which may help explain why we are where we are. You were also in the Biden administration, special envoy to Iran. You served in the Clinton administration, and you are co-author with Hussein Agha of Tomorrow's Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. And you and I had a conversation about that on this podcast some months ago. But we're going to talk about Iran today and the war. We're taping this at a moment of some drama, I guess. It looks as if at the moment these negotiations in Pakistan are going to go ahead between the Iran and the U.S. That's not quite nailed down. Meanwhile, the ceasefire is set to expire, I think, something like 30 hours from now. So things are in flux. I'm going to start with a question that I think will be relevant regardless of how these things play out. And it has to do with the prospects for a long-term deal between Iran and the U.S. If anybody followed the price of oil over the past week, they will see changes that reflect kind of fluctuating hopes for a deal. As of Friday night, there was talk, first of all, people were saying, well, the Strait of Hormuz is going to reopen as before the war, and this reflects that the two sides, you know, there's a discernible outlines of a deal on kind of everything. It would even solve the nuclear issue and so on. Since then, those hopes have gotten a little cloudier. So I'd like to ask you, because this really is the heart of your expertise, two questions about the prospects for a deal. First of all, as you, to the extent that you can sense the kind of state of mind of the Iranian regime and the Trump administration, do you think there is in principle a deal that could resolve the nuclear issue as well as ending the war? Do you see the broad outlines of something that would be acceptable to both sides? And secondly, there's the question of whether it's an executable deal. In other words, like, given the level of diplomatic and substantive expertise in the Trump administration, given the fact that the administration is hostage to Trump's changes of mood or whatever they are, and also given on the other side some reports of dissension within the Iranian regime, certainly reports that this is a harder line regime than the previous regime, you know, is the deal, even if it's in principle doable, you know, can we actually stick the landing? I want to start with the first one. And if you say no to the first one, then the second one is, I guess we can skip. But is there in principle a deal that is discernible from your point of view?
So I would say yes. I've thought that for some time, subject to the huge caveat that you mentioned, which is I really don't know what President Trump is looking for. I don't think he knows it himself. So we can't put that aside, but let's sort of caveat that and say, objectively, if you had, given what the interests of the both sides seem to be, I could well imagine a deal, not a comprehensive deal. I mean, this notion of a deal that's going to touch on missiles and on the drones and on Iran's posture in the region. I mean, I always say if that's going to be on the table, then America's posture in the region and America's arms sales in the region and America's support for Israel in the region will also be on the table. So I put that aside. But a sort of narrow deal that would deal with the nuclear issue and the Strait of Hormuz, which seem to be the two biggest ones right now, and of course, sanctions relief or economic relief for Iran, I could see the outlines. I'll do my best to try to present it. So on the Strait of Hormuz, it is pretty straightforward. You open up the Strait of Hormuz to regular traffic, and there'd have to be some mechanism that Iran might call war reparations, some might call economic relief, you could call it sanctions relief, but some means that Iran would feel like giving up that card, which is a big card for them, but they're going to need enormous economic backing or some resources to make up for the huge destruction that the war has caused. So that's on the one hand, you know, not saying it's easy, but I could imagine that. On the nuclear side, what the U.S. will want, first and foremost, is the turning over the 400 plus kilograms of highly enriched uranium and a period of years during which Iran would not enrich. There's a lot of other details about, you know, what happens after that, but let's at least give the narrow case, which is they stop enriching and they turn over the stockpile of enriched uranium, and there's some inspections that are resumed, i.e.
And would part of that also be an agreement that, you know, if the end of enrichment, if that moratorium ends in, say, a few years, 5 years, which I gather was Iran's last known position or reported position, would after that there be a return to something like the Obama deal in this view? So, I think Trump needs to be able to say, you know, that he's got something better than the Obama deal in some sense, right?
Right. But what I'm trying to give you is sort of the most immediate deal that they could have within a matter of days, because Trump being as, you know, impatient as he is and as whimsical as he is. So, yes, that's why I say they're going to have to deal with what happens at the end of those 5 years or 7 years or whatever it is, 10 years that they suspend enrichment. What kind of what rights would they have during even that period in terms of R&D, research and development, building centrifuges? So there's a lot of detail, and I'll come then to the question of are they equipped to negotiate those details. But if you just want to get a deal that says, okay, we're ending the war, here's what they're doing on the Strait of Hormuz. On the nuclear side, they're taking some immediate steps, and then we're going to buy the time to negotiate everything that you mentioned. I can imagine, and of course, Iran is going to require in return even more sanctions relief, even more access to their frozen assets, something of that magnitude. I think the question about implementation, which is, and again, this is just a very narrow deal. We could imagine more, but if this narrow deal, the question of execution and implementation is going to be difficult for one core reason, which is if you were an Iranian, you wouldn't have an ounce of trust that what the negotiators are telling you is what the president means, and what the president says is what he intends to do. So you're going to say any deal like this, we're giving up something that's concrete and that is in some ways irreversible. We hand over the 400 kilograms plus highly enriched uranium. We're not going to get it back. What you're going to give us, which is sanctions relief or access to frozen assets, you could turn it off within a nanosecond. We've proved it in the past, right? I mean, I could give you examples even under the Biden administration, under the Trump administration, where sanctions or gestures that were promised were then reneged upon. So I think that's going to be the difficult piece, because if you're Iran, you're going to say, I will not, maybe you hand over the 400 kilograms in increments and you see how the U.S. lives up to in the end of the bargain. It's going to be complicated. I don't know whether the president and this administration has the appetite and the patience for that kind of complexity. He's going to want something spectacular, dramatic, all in one go. That's very hard to do. And again, you'd have to find, you know, the JCPOA was built not on trust, but at least there was this, I think the Iranians believed that if the U.S. made a commitment, they would live up to it. So they, in fact, the JCPOA, Iran's nuclear commitments were all front-loaded. By the time the U.S. lifted the first sanction, Iran had already completed all of they had shipped out or down-blended their enriched uranium. They'd taken out whatever they had to take out. No way Iran would agree to that now. So you're going to have to find another architecture.
Okay. And did we kind of slow walk the sanctions relief even last time when we had a more reliable administration, or is that wrong?
So, I mean, slow. I think the Iranians expected that the U.S. would go all out, or not all out, would make it a proactive effort to reassure people who wanted to do business with Iran that the sanctions are not in place. I think Secretary Kerry actually tried. He went on a road trip in which he tried to convince foreign banks, which drove the Treasury Department crazy. But I think what we learned in that experience is that you could lift some sanctions, but if the primary embargo is still there and the threat of sanctions still remains, very few people are going to be willing to do a deal, to do business with Iran. And so it was much less than, at a minimum, we had represented to the Iranians would be the case and that the Iranians had expected they would benefit from. So, you know, you could look at it and say the U.S. could have done more than they committed to on paper, because on paper there wasn't that much. I think we discovered that it's very hard to convince people to do business with Iran when you have the threat of U.S. sanctions. If they slip, if you're an investor or you want to trade with Iran and you make a mistake and you're going to get sanctioned by the U.S., it's going to cost you much more than whatever benefit you could get from dealing with Iran. And so people stayed away. And I think the Obama administration didn't feel that it was its duty to twist people's arms and say, no, now go ahead and invest in Iran. So I think Iran learned the lesson that next time they're going to be much more careful about how the sanctions relief is implemented.
Okay. So you're imagining, first of all, I guess, a thing where Trump says, hey, they're stopping enrichment, something that they've never agreed to before, even if it's if there's some finite period. Strait of Hormuz is open, there's sanctions relief. And maybe they then immediately begin negotiating, you know, what happens after the enrichment period. Do they again get to enrich up to 3% with very strict monitoring and inspections as last time? So, but you don't expect that part to happen now. I guess.
No.
I would ask, isn't there one other concern that Iran has, which is how do they be sure that they're not going to get attacked again by Israel in a year? That is very high, I gather, on their list of priorities. Now, they have demonstrated this time around, and this is from their point of view of enduring strategic value, I think, that they have the capacity to make things very hard for the world economy. And they're just always going to have that. I think one thing we've learned is that the advent of drones only increases their ability to close the Strait of Hormuz whenever they want. I mean, you can bring in all the minesweepers you want, but if they can fire a drone from 100 miles inland, that you know, hits a tanker, doesn't kill anybody, but scares insurance companies, you know, that's real power. So they would have that. But it seems to me one problem, like I've heard a lot of people say, well, ultimately Iran is going to want security guarantees. And I'm like, what are you talking about? A piece of paper that's signed by Trump and Netanyahu? Iran would be crazy to put any stock in that kind of long-term guarantee of non-aggression. China doesn't want to put troops in the Middle East and so on. So are you assuming that Iran would have to take its kind of consolation so far as, you know, ushering in some enduring peace in just its now demonstrated ability to blow up the global economy? Or are you imagining some part of the deal that strengthens Iran's sense of reassurance beyond that?
So it's a great question. I've always had that. I've always wondered, what does Iran mean when it says it wants security guarantees? I just want to make a parallel to something that we encountered under the Biden administration. There, Iran was making very legitimate claims, saying, what guarantee do we have that a future president is not going to tear up the deal? We want a guarantee that it won't happen. And we told them, there's no such guarantee. We can't promise that the future president won't do it. What we could tell you is you have proven your deterrent. Your deterrent is you rebuild your nuclear program. So it's kind of exactly what you're saying now. Not sure that they completely bought it, but that's what we were telling them, which is if we violate the deal, you rebuild the nuclear program. Why do you think we're at the table now? It's because we don't like you doing that, and so we're going to have to come back. Mm-hmm. So my view is what the only security guarantee Iran will have is their ability to do what they did this time in terms of blocking the Strait of Hormuz. Now, over time, I'm not an economist. This is not my domain, but I assume a lot of countries are going to try to find workarounds to the Strait of Hormuz, land bridges, other ways. Mm-hmm. Israel is talking about it. Syria might be involved. The Saudis are looking at it. So I wonder whether over time it becomes a diminishing asset, and Iran may worry about that. But in the short term, they do have that security guarantee. But there's a wrinkle, of course, which is, you know, Israel doesn't mind as much. Closing the Strait of Hormuz, I'm sure Israel doesn't love it, but they have, in their hierarchy of interests, they would today be prepared to continue the war, even if it meant wreaking havoc on the world economy for another month, 2 months. So they have that threat. They would need to be confident that the U.S. would put enough pressure on Israel to stop a war if Israel were to start it. And then, of course, the other wrinkle to the wrinkle is, if you're Iran and you want to maintain the deterrent capacity, you're going to want to maintain a missile and drone arsenal, you're going to want to replenish it. Israel, when it sees that happening, is going to have an incentive to try to stop it before it gets, you know, back to the level that it was before the war. So in order to resolve this conflict in a long-term sustainable way, more fundamental things are going to have to change, having to do with the security architecture of the region. And that is something that is well beyond the capacity of the moment. But that's why anything that's going to be reached, whether it's the smaller deal that I spoke to you about, or over time, a bigger one that deals with the longer term issue of the nuclear program, it's going to be very hard to have it, you know, to consider it really stable, because at a minimum, the Israeli-Iranian dynamic is going to be fraught.
Yeah. And we should say that Israel is not going to be wild about the kind of deal we've been talking about, I think. And Bibi Netanyahu may try to disrupt it before it even coalesces, or disrupt it early, you know, early on in its life or something like we can expect that, you think?
I think there are many who are going to try to disrupt it. It has enough inherent disruptions, and all it takes is for somebody to whisper in Trump's ear that he's being taken for a ride and that this deal is not it doesn't meet what his own objectives. I just can't predict, and I spend too much time reading every utterance that President Trump makes, and I think we all should make it a vow not to listen to what he says, because it has no relationship to reality and in decreasing relationship to what he himself may think at any given time.
It's funny how the press still reports what he says as if it matters. And every once in a while it does, but it's like so much of this thing is obviously, this stuff is just obviously the latest mood swing or what he thinks of as a tactical maneuver or something. Yeah. And it's like, you know, Trump now says there won't be a second ceasefire. I mean, give me a break. That bears no correlation to the probability of there being a second ceasefire. Yeah. So anyway,
as you're talking, I'm thinking back about sort of the deal that I was describing. And sorry if I'm rolling the tape a little bit back. As I said, what may be most difficult for Iran, because they don't trust the U.S. and they trust Trump even less than they trust the United States, is giving up something tangible like the 400 kilograms of high-enriched uranium. So you can even imagine Trump may not go for this, but an even more modest deal in which the Strait of Hormuz is open, they get some relief in exchange, and they agree to suspend enrichment for a number of years, which in any event, they can't really enrich right now because there's been so much destruction, but they make that commitment that they won't for a period of years. And they leave even the 400 kilograms buried underneath the rubble. Very hard for Iran to get it anyway. And Trump could say, if I see any movement by Iran to try to extract it, we'll bomb them. So it's in a sort of an accordion. You could have from the minimalist deal, which at least buys you time to negotiate the rest. And then you could get more and more ambitious. Given the time frames under which the president seems to be operating, I would assume a more minimalist concrete deal. And then a number of principles, the way he likes doing it with Gaza and 20 principles, 10 principles, whatever, which they then have to iron out and which they may never even get to.
From their point of view, giving up the right of enrichment is of rhetorical value to them, and that's probably why this would have to be a finite period. And then giving up the actual enriched uranium would be pretty big ask, I guess, from their point of view. It seems like the other area where in principle you could you could fiddle with knobs that would make it more in Iran's interest, is the Strait of Hormuz. And I guess you can't, just because Trump is now so committed to the full reopening of the Strait. But you can imagine, like, if I'm Iran, here's what I would say, and this is probably why I'm not running a country, like this, but among other reasons, but I'd say, like, look, okay, we have been charging $2 million a tanker. That's like $1 a gallon or dollar a barrel, okay?
Yeah.
So, and this is 20% of the world's oil, so we're adding 20 cents a barrel. And this war has added like $35, $40 a barrel, okay? So we'd be adding 20 cents to an average price of $60, $65. So first of all, like, we're not talking about long-term damage to the world economy if we kept doing this, you know, like if they were going to ask to normalize this. And then I would say, and look, you know, we've added up how much destruction, how much we spent on weapons in fighting off this plainly illegal aggression that violated the UN Charter. We've added up the damage to infrastructure, and we've come up with a number. You know, it would be in over $100 billion. I'm sure that wouldn't be a crazy thing, whatever it is. And you say, look, we have a right to keep collecting this toll until we get that much money. And if the U.S. or Israel wants to pay us off early, fine. Do the reparations, which, of course, the U.S. and Israel can't do for domestic political reasons. But it's a very reasonable sounding thing. Now, they might further say, you know, here's another to just depart further from reality. And or maybe we're going to go to, you know, $2 a barrel, but we are going to split it with the Gulf states that also have their rebuilding to do. All of that damage is a consequence of this illegal aggression. And, you know, maybe nominally the partner is Oman, and then Oman redistributes it among the Gulf states or something. Seems to me that would sound pretty damn reasonable. And I would start talking that way, you know, rather than, right? I mean, wouldn't that, what am I doing wrong here?
It's interesting because some people have been speaking about an outcome like that. The Gulf states are, GCC states are adamant against it. Now, and so they don't even want to hear about it because they are.
Even if they get a piece of the action?
That's what I don't know. And I don't know I think right now, as a matter of principle, the Gulf states say we will not even talk about it. Oman may be the exception, but even they have been very reluctant. They just think that it would be giving Iran too much. And it's also, you know, I'm not an expert on the law of the sea, and I know that Iran hasn't ratified the convention, but it's not lawful. But okay, we'd just be piling one more illegality. Now, if it gets endorsed by the Security Council, then of course you could make it legal. I wonder. I mean, I'm open-minded about this. I could imagine, again, if it's a collective decision that is made and the GCC countries see that they also get a share of reconstruction, I'd put it on the table. The point is, Iran is going to insist, I believe, that if it's going to give anything up on the Strait or on anything, you know, I think about it this way. I mean, this war is, as you said, it's unlawful. It was unjustified. It was unnecessary. It also is extraordinarily costly, particularly to non-Americans. I mean, you know, America mm-hmm. has to suffer from increase of the price of the pump, and maybe the stock market has suffered a bit, and you know, 13 Americans were killed. I'm sure many more were injured. But a month or two after the war, most Americans will not even remember that it took place. In Iran, it's going to stay with them for a generation because of the reason you gave, you know, hundreds of billions maybe of dollars to rebuild. For the Gulf countries, also long term. And for countries in the global south, you know, the price of fertilizers, of everything, of basic commodities. So, you know, we could sit here and think of solutions that are going to be adequate, but I do think we have to at least pause and remember how extraordinarily reckless this war was because of the cost it's going to have, the indirect cost it's going to have for so many. Now, so one would hope that there'd be a way to compensate the countries that have suffered, but maybe Iran has a way to do it. Maybe the GCC countries have a way to do it. But for all the others, it's just going to be a net loss. And that's, you know, so many reasons to be angry at this war, but that's one that gets, I think, a little bit underreported.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little about the Iranian regime. I mean, again, as for the fact that the Well, let's actually just revisit the situation briefly on the Trump side, which is, it must to you, because you, again, were a leading negotiator in the Obama deal. And that was a massive undertaking in terms of like intellectual resources, like a huge amount of diplomatic and substantive expertise was brought to bear. The deal wound up being 160 pages. There were all these stops and starts, and I gotta think, you know, and the Secretary of Energy really knew nuclear stuff was part of it. And I gotta think, when you look at like who they're sending to this thing, and then you see how policy seems to happen within the Trump administration, it just must kind of shock you. Like, I mean, I know you're not as inclined as I am to say unkind things about people, but like, this is, I almost don't see how you have any hope at all, right? Of them actually sticking a landing. Now, I do see the beauty of your very streamlined conception of what could happen now, which is like, okay, you know, the end of enrichment is a clear-cut thing for the time being. There's a finite period of time. Strait of Hormuz opens, a couple of other things happen. That we can get on a few pages of paper, and Trump can hold all of that in his mind, and you can do it, and then all the details about a longer-term deal work out later. I see the beauty of that. But, I mean, what is it like for you to have been part of a professional diplomatic operation and, you know, that befits a superpower, and then see this thing happening?
Yeah, I mean, again, we could go on and use all kind of unkind words. I do think the best we're going to get now is something that's pretty streamlined, and then kick the can down the road with principles that will govern what comes next. Yeah, I mean, the JCPOA, who knows? Maybe it was the last hurrah of that kind of agreement. I mean, it really was a six-ring circus or more, because, and it's just almost impossible to see this administration doing anything close to that, which is, first, you needed to have agreements within the administration itself. You know, people love to talk about divisions on the Iranian side. Well, there always are divisions on the American side. Mm-hmm. Pentagon has a view, the Treasury Department has a view, the State Department has a view, the White House has a view. So that was herding cats just at that level. You had to get had to get Congress on board, which was another tough thing. You had to get the Russians.
Yeah. I think it was a heroic political effort by Obama, given the domestic resistance from his own, within his own party.
He had to overcome objection from his own party. And then he had to get the Russians, the Chinese, the Europeans on board. He had to make sure that he would neutralize opposition from Israel, which wasn't easy, opposition from the Gulf states. And only after all that is done, you get the negotiation with Iran. So it really does require a team, patience. And, you know, people tell me, well, how what do you think about Witkoff and Vance and Kushner being there? At some level, I don't really care. I mean, I could say some things I would criticize, but the heads of the team matter, but it's the experts behind them. Right, I mean, I'm not a nuclear expert. I'm not a sanctions expert. I don't think Secretary Kerry or Wendy Sherman were either. But they had with them people who were absolutely steeped in the details of all of this. From what I hear, now maybe this time is different. When Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner travel, they don't take experts with them. So I don't know if they rely on others, but not on the American experts. So that's why, again, is another reason why I suspect this will be something pretty streamlined, as you say. I think you put it well, that President Trump could read and basically understand and be able to frame as a resounding success the end of a 4,000-year conflict that we've had with Iran.
And if they're not relying on American experts, I mean, who would they be relying on?
So in Geneva, when they were negotiating, I understand they were relying on the head of the IEA, Rafael Grossi, which is, I mean, it's odd.
You can do worse, I'm sure,
You could do worse. Now, you know, he's running to be the Secretary General of the UN, so he puts him in an awkward position. I think he's always, it's great to have him there, but he can't be the person on whom you're relying to do the deal.
Yeah. Okay. I guess that makes sense. So as for the Iranian side, now in the course of this fluctuating hope for a deal over the last week, Some people started saying they saw signs of real dissension within the Iranian regime, even a struggle for power. Other people said that was largely a misinterpretation. Apparently, one thing that happened was initially it sounded like both sides had agreed to really open the Strait of Hormuz, and something that the foreign minister said or tweeted seemed to sustain that idea. And then I guess somebody from the IRGC referred to some idiot who had said this strait was going to fully reopen, and some people took that to be a reference to the Iranian foreign minister. Others said no, they were talking about Trump. Even yeah. So, it sounds like, and that's your view, it sounds like. But
I don't know, but that, well, I'll answer your question later. But
even so, it sounds like they weren't exactly on the same page. I mean, it's funny. In general, Iran, this was true earlier too, they had a way of talking about their plan to continue to control the strait in a very subdued way. Like, I think back around the ceasefire or something, if you looked at what they said, traffic will flow, you know, freely. And then it said something about in coordination with the Iranian military and blah, blah, blah. And you kind of, if you read closely, you realize what that means is no, they still want tolls and they want to decide who goes and doesn't, but they didn't say it out loud. So, they didn't say it very loud. So what is your take on, in light of these, the last week's seeming occasional discord of the state of the Iranian regime, the degree of unity? I mean, everyone says the IRGC is more powerful than it was before they decapitated the regime. But how unified is the regime?
And I often find these debates a little bit odd in the sense that, you know, if it was a dictatorship and the supreme leader made all the decisions, there was no disharmony, people would say, oh, it's a dictatorship, it's an autocracy. And then when there's debate, they point to it as if it's a, you know, a remarkable feature. Of course, there's different views. I mean, there's different mm-hmm. centers of power. It's not a unitary system in which everything flows from the top. There are, you know, and the supreme leader has been as much the arbiter as the decider in the past. That was true under the, you know, Khamenei, and I suspect it's even more true now with the son, who doesn't have as much, I assume, as much authority as the father did. So, yeah, they're different points of view, different interests. Sometimes I'm sure the debates are extraordinarily vehement because, well, just even in the times when we were negotiating, but now when it's matters of life and death and the existence of the regime. So I would be shocked if you didn't have very strongly competing views. Mm-hmm. So what? I mean, I think that and that is those divisions or those dissent may be exacerbated by the fact that their leadership has been killed, so there's less authority, there's more decentralization, fragmentation. I would say, and this is not, I'm not there, so I can't say this for a fact, but it seems to me quite remarkable that despite the decapitation of the regime, despite the fact that you would now have, by definition, very competing views and perhaps even a struggle for who's going to be end up on top once the dust settles, is that they still are able to make decisions. They've made decisions in terms of the conduct of the war. They've made decisions in terms of the ceasefire. They made a decision, even it may sound innocuous, but I was struck by the fact that in the middle of the war, they agreed to release two of the French hostages who had been held for years. Mm-hmm. I just thought, this is a strange time. And how did they even get to the point? Because let's not forget, it's very hard for them to even communicate with one another.
Yep.
I mean, would you be in a room with three other decision makers and not suspect that a bomb is going to land on your head, even in the middle of peace talks?
Well, and so, wouldn't you worry that if Israel has this ability to assassinate people so prolifically that any cell phone conversation you have, for all you know, is going to give away your whereabouts? I mean, I have been surprised by how coherent the escalation escalation signaling has been. Yep. I mean, honestly, they look more coherent than we do. I mean, they have a strategy, and it's discernible, you know?
So you took the words exactly out of my mouth. I mean, if you're going to compare who's more predictable, who's more institutionalized, which is more personalized, Iran has been far more predictable from day one of the war than certainly the White House has been. Iran has been more institutionalized. I mean, there is a process. There's divisions, there's dissent. I'm not defending it. I'm not saying this is all harmonious. I'm sure there's very ugly fights and within it, but there's a process and the decision reflects the process. Is there a process right now in the U.S. government? Everything I hear, there is not. Certainly not a process that extends beyond the president and a few people around him. And the U.S. system, by definition, right now is far more personalized than anything that's occurring in Iran. So, yeah, I think we could spend time, and I see it on X or Twitter, people saying, aha, there's division. Of course, let's state it as a fact. There are intense divisions, rivalries, competition within the system. That's less the question than whether, despite those divisions, rivalries, mm-hmm. competition, they can make a decision and make it stick. I think over the last couple of days, and I don't know what happened, it does seem like maybe the disharmony has affected to some extent the decision-making about the Strait of Hormuz. I don't know. But even then, it wouldn't be shocking in a situation of warfare where, as you and I have said, it must be so hard for them to coordinate, even if, mm-hmm. under the best of circumstances between the IRGC and the foreign ministry and others, their different interests. I still, at this point, don't know how physically they communicate and they can make a decision and then convey that decision to everyone who needs to implement it. Because, I mean, I'd say if I was sitting with three people in the Iranian decision-making circle, I'd have to wonder whether one of them was a spy, because they've been so penetrated. Yeah. That. So I think it would be interesting to figure out, and there have been some reports that to get to the Supreme Leader, they use pieces of paper, and a courier has to do it. It's a bit like what happened in Gaza with Hamas. That's the way the communication took place, because they were so convinced, and rightly so, that any communication that was electronic would be immediately detected, and the person at the other end of the phone would be killed.
So you think the new Supreme Leader is in charge?
I don't know. This I'm just following. I mean, the press is reporting it. This is what American intelligence thinks. I have no idea. And in charge at this stage would probably mean, if it's the case, that he has to give the ultimate green light as a result of his arbitrating and mediating between very competing views. Again, how it would happen, we have a vague sense of how it happened under his father, because there was the National Security Council that met, and he, in the end, had to green light any fundamental decision, like the decision to agree to the JCPOA, which was not, unanimous. I'm sure it wasn't consensual, but he ultimately mm-hmm. made that decision. But weighing the competing views of different parties and making sure that whatever decision was consensual enough that it wouldn't lead to dissent, active dissent. How they do it under today's situation, I'm not sure. But again, I think at this point, if tomorrow there were a deal between the U.S. and Iran, sounds strange to say it, but I would have greater faith in the fact that Iran would implement it than that the U.S. would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I would think they've used the ceasefire to try to come up with some means of communication, internal communication.
Would you trust that the ceasefire is going to be respected?
You mean if you're Iran, would you trust it?
Yeah. So I still wouldn't.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, that's why, on the one hand, I think I'd be damn reluctant to give up control of the Strait of Hormuz. On the other hand, they've demonstrated they can take it in effect at any moment. So maybe I'm overthinking that part. But sure. And this is why, honestly, the deal you described, not that easy for me to imagine the Iranian regime.
Here's two reactions to the good points you're making. First, I think you're right that, well, if tomorrow the war ends and the strait is open and Iran is not satisfied with what it gets in return, I'm not sure how easy it will be for them to then close it. I mean, they could start charging greater toll fares, whatever. But at some point, if the U.S. is not actively bombing them and Israel is not actively bombing them,
right,
they're going to come under a lot of pressure from China, from the rest of the world, saying, wait a minute, you're hurting us now. So I do wonder how long-lasting that asset is, just in a situation where it's not warfare, but just the U.S. is not living up to its end of the bargain. So that's one reason why I would say, like you, they're going to ask for a high price to restore normalcy on the Strait of Hormuz, because I just don't know whether 6 months, a year from now, they could simply light that switch again and say, we're going back to closing the Strait of Hormuz. But you know, maybe at that point they increase the toll, of which, and everyone is going to protest. But again, then they would be viewed as the bad guys. So I don't know. I think it's going to be tricky for them to do it. On the other hand, so my second reaction to your point is, at some point, the war has to end. I mean, the cost to Iran is still, particularly if the war resumes with active military strikes, I mean, how are they going to sustain it? How are they going to govern? How are they going to recover? So they, at some point, they have to end the war. They're not going to get the security guarantees. You and I agree to that. They might get some guarantees about reconstruction funds, although even those, I don't know how they are trusted. So they're going to have to settle for something less than ideal. And then I think there's going to be a significant reckoning in Iran when they find that they're not able to address the needs of their people. And there's going to be significant unrest and anger, maybe not right away. So again, I it's hard to mm-hmm. see a future that is bright for the Islamic Republic. Now may be the moment where they have maximum leverage, which is why I think they're going to try to extract the maximum price for restoring some form of normalcy in the Strait of Hormuz. But even then, it's just that asset, as I said, has diminishing returns over time.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as you know, Rob, the pattern on this podcast is to talk for a while, quite a while publicly, and then go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I encourage everyone to become. I also encourage you to check out the last podcast with Rob about his book, or if you just want to cut straight to the chase and read the book, it's called Tomorrow is Yesterday. And it draws on, we should say, your experience as a negotiator on the Israel-Palestine thing with on the U.S. team. And your co-author in the book, and you wrote what I think is a landmark piece of revisionist history in the New York Review of Books a couple of decades ago, revisiting the Camp David thing and calling into question the narrative that Arafat just inexplicably turned down a wonderful offer that had no downsides from the point of view of any reasonable Palestinian. I'm a little caricaturing the conventional wisdom that you took issue with, but not by all that much.
I don't think you're caricaturing it at all. But that's
and you were there. You were at Camp David on the U.S. team, and your co-author was an advisor to the Palestinian side, co-author of the book and co-author of that piece of writing in the New York Review of Books. Okay, so I want to continue this question in overtime about how the war ends. Talk a little more about Trump. See if you get any edgier in your description of him when there's a paywall. We'll see. Maybe talk a little about the blockade and this also this idea of this new quartet in the Middle East that we're hearing about. I guess Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, whether they could be a counterweight to Israel, and what exactly they're up to right now in what they're doing, maybe to some extent behind the scenes. I don't know. Okay, so thanks everybody who's followed us so far. I hope you'll follow us into overtime. You can find in the show notes the link to become a paid subscriber.